Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and joining to me today is the spectacular film distributor of TAL Films, Nadine Mai. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Nadine Mai, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Phew, all this time on Twitter I've been saying it in my head that way.
It's funny, it seems as if Canadians and North Americans are the only people on this planet that can pronounce my name correct. it's really funny. So congratulations to you.
You also have the blog The Art of Slow Cinema, which is I think how it was first introduced to you. And it's hard to explain the appeal of slow films sometimes to other people who aren't interested in them. A lot of people sometimes say that a film is bad because it's slow, yep. Or use it as a criticism. So, and even I found sometimes even in academic circles, it's not like they're maybe watching a slow film the same way that I like to. So it was a big relief to find your blog, because I felt like not only do you get it, but you introduced me to so many things. Like I think that was the first place I had heard of Lav Diaz's films and a number of other filmmakers.
That's really great. That's good to hear from me. But I'm really trying to write from an experiential point of view. I know that academics really try to use existing frameworks to read the slow films. And mm-hmm. I don't think this is always useful. I mean, actually, the writing about slow film is boring. So the slow films themselves seem boring as well. That's really an issue nowadays. So it's difficult to tell people, hey, slow films are really interesting. But as soon as they read about the films, they become really bored because the writing is boring. So I'm really mm-hmm. trying to make it a bit different. But it's good to hear that I seem to succeed.
Yeah, I appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thanks.
And today we're going to be talking about a film that's both slow and long, but has a reputation as maybe one of the best films of the 21st century so far. It's Wong Bing's Tie Shi Chu, West of the Tracks. It's a little over 9-hour documentary about a collapsing industrial district in China. It's split into three segments: Rust, Remnants, and Rails. So I think sometimes it's screened by each segment, so people don't necessarily watch it all at once. How did you watch it?
I watched it all at once.
There we go.
No, because I think you have to. Here in France, I don't know who is the distributor of the DVD I actually had, but the film came in four DVDs exactly, so they cut even Rust, the first part, into two segments. Mm-hmm. And it said specifically, I think on the back of the DVDs, that every segment can be watched individually. And what they did was, at the beginning of each DVD, they gave the exact same intro you had at the very beginning of the film, so that you basically have all the info you need in order to watch each segment. You could watch the parts individually. You could. They're very much self-containing. On the other hand, I think you really need to sit through these 9 hours in one go in order to get the feeling of the slow collapse of the industrial complex and what it means, or what it meant, for the workers who worked there and who lived in the surroundings. If you just watch the parts individually, say with a couple of days in between, I don't think you really get the sense of hard labor and of suffering. You merely mm-hmm. see really you just see the images, but you don't really feel the images. And there's a lot of experience. I find that Wang Bing tries to transmit to the viewer, which, just like with Lav Diaz, because he's also making these long films, you should really try to watch it in one go. So I know that cinemas are always wary of doing this, because They're worried that people can't sit through 9 hours. At the same time, I tell myself that people binge watch TV series for hours on end. And at the same time, it is if you show the three parts individually with a day in between, you cannot guarantee that the viewers are actually coming back. So it's complete waste, if you ask me.
Yeah, even theatrically, I was looking into how it was distributed. It was often shown Rust with an intermission on the first day and then Remnants and Rails on the second day. But I think you're right that it does make a difference to see it all in one go. And you're right, too. People will often binge watch some some ridiculous television show.
Yep.
You know, easily 9 hours all in one lazy Saturday, and then
yeah.
Talk about this like it's completely unwatchable. But
at the same time, in these TV series, I mean, they're constructed in such a way that there's really a lot happening.
Yes.
Which, I mean, compared to a TV series, you cannot say the same thing about West of the Tracks. Yes, there is a lot happening, but it's not the kind of action thing that you might, or the kind of, the revelation of secrets between characters in a TV series that just keeps on going, and the cliffhangers. You don't have that in Wang Bing's films. So no. I think that this is perhaps what makes it more difficult to watch this film. And it's not exactly entertaining. It's not a cheery film either. So, I think this is what makes people maybe wary of even trying to watch the film.
I mean, I wouldn't want to scare people away because it is a special experience, I think.
It is.
Watching it, especially for the first time. And watching it all together, I found there was a sense of the focus maybe narrowing gradually throughout. It starts off very large, and I think of the mostly at the beginning the shots of the factories and the workers' conversations in it, and by the end you feel like it's narrowed down to being more about a community and then maybe more about individuals, the father and son near the end. You know, it becomes maybe more personal as it goes on.
That is the same impression I had. But this impression only came to me a couple of days after I had watched the film. Because if you watch it in one go, it can be all very overwhelming. But once you give it a bit of time, you've got certain scenes crystallizing out. And it's true that especially Rust is... I mean, I see the film as going from a macrocosmos to a microcosmos. And the first part, Rust, is, as you said, you know, very much about the factories themselves. There are a lot of shots of the buildings themselves, the outside, the inside. You've got a large group of workers. The second part, Remnants, that goes into the community that lives around the factories.
The buildings where the workers live are being torn down. Yes.
Exactly, the Rainbow Row. And the third part is, I find, the most moving part, because Wang Bing really goes into individual suffering, and the depiction of the old man with his son, that was really one of the most moving sections I have seen in recent times.
Yes. I think, too, like, also watching it for the first time, maybe if you watch it in segments, you might get the wrong impression of what the film is. Like, I've seen some criticism. Somebody said, oh, this is maybe voyeuristic, or, you know, but I looked and they only reviewed just the first segment. They treated it like a film on its own.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it maybe gives the wrong impression if you don't follow it all the way to the end. It's like the image of the rails that it keeps coming back to, you feel like you keep moving forward and forward, and you're going further into this world. It starts maybe at its broadest point. And there are times I even thought, watching the first segment, it looked almost like science fiction to me. It seemed so alien, these factories with these enormous machines that are all decaying and rusting, and you have the smoke and the sometimes strange light colors, pink lights, green lights. It felt like
certain scenes, yeah, and they reminded me of the film Dead Slow Ahead, which is also the
right,
sort of
yes.
sci-fi, and especially the colors, the red color in particular, came to my mind when I watched the first part of Wang Bing's film, because it's very similar. At the same
Yes.
time, what you said about voyeurism, I think this is very much a typical reading of a handheld camera, which we have. And it is true that in a lot of instances, Wang Bing tends to film secretly because, I mean, he doesn't have anything official. He tries to avoid censorship, so he's just filming whenever he can. And I think that was the case with West of the Tracks as well. He did have people in the factory on the railways working there who could help him. Nevertheless, it was not in an officially supported project. And I think in one or two scenes, you could even see that people did not want to be filmed.
Yes.
So, and he kept filming, I think. I think this is where the idea of voyeurism comes from. He tries to become part of the fabric of the workers, and yet he isn't.
Right.
So,
I think it took him over 2 years to film,
yes.
because it begins in 1999 and ends in, I think, spring
2001.
2001.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's quite a long time he spent there. So I think it's a similar experience of anytime you enter a new community and are an outsider, eventually you sort of find your place in it and find these more intimate moments available to you. I had a little bit of that sense while watching it too.
I think he's a filmmaker who's generally trying to do this. As far as I remember from something I read in a new book about him from last year, it's a French language book, which is a collection of interviews with him, his producer, and I think some essays. He said that for West of the Tracks, he was actually moving to that region, if I'm correct, just in order to get a sense of what it was like, and just this time spending there, he got a sense of what he could film, what he should film, what definitely must be on record. And West of the Tracks is not the only film where he has done it. I think he did the same with A Man with No Name, Coal Money, which is very similar, just a lot shorter. But yeah, I think Wang Bing is really a filmmaker who, before he starts to film, he wants to get a sense of the surrounding, of the people, and then in this way find out what is best to capture and how to capture it as well. He's very conscious of that.
I think there was one moment when a worker turns and tells him, "Oh, you better get this factory on film. It won't be around much longer."
Yes.
And that's exactly what he's doing. I wondered too if this film, I don't think it would have been possible to make this without the DV cameras that he had available that were, I think, still fairly new at the time, inexpensive digital video camera. I know. Do you have any thoughts about the use of digital video as opposed to film in making this documentary?
You're absolutely right. I think without digital, West of the Tracks wouldn't exist. First of all, digital is cheap, you're right. At the same time, as I said before, he shot a lot of the scenes secretly, and you cannot exactly go there with a big crew and a big analog film camera. It's not doable. What you need is a small camera that can even be hidden from time to time. And also a camera that is very mobile. You know, what I find important in Wang Bing's films is that he reacts to whatever is happening in front of him. He doesn't really have a script, he's just filming. And I haven't seen the film, but I heard people talking about this one scene in what's his latest. No, his film from 2014 in the mental health.
Till madness do us part, maybe.
Yes, that's the one where one of the inmates just starts running and he immediately decides to run after him. And you see that in West of the Tracks a lot as well, that sometimes he just decides to follow one character and leave one behind. And you really need to be very flexible, very mobile, and this is only possible with a small digital camera. I think the camera he had really made West of the Tracks possible. It gave him flexibility, it gave him mobility, and I think with analog it wouldn't have been doable. I love analog film, I really do. But I think West of the Tracks wouldn't have been doable with analog film.
I heard also some criticism, people saying, well, it's or maybe not even criticism, but people trying to say that it's unconcerned with aesthetics. But I had sort of a different reaction. I think maybe digital video, especially from that time when it didn't look comparable to film, people might assume it's ugly just inherently. But I thought so many of the images were really striking that he could capture, and he had a very strong sense of where to put the camera, even with motion that he, of course, he has no control over, the way he frames, the way he uses the available light. I wasn't surprised when I found out after his background was training as a cinematographer. Could you see that in the film, or what did you think?
It depends on what you do with your education, put it like this, because you've got, or what you want to do with your education. Because look, for example, at Balata. He's trained, but his films look entirely different because he wants them to be like this. I think West of the Tracks has to be down to earth in order to bring the message across. The film is not unconcerned with aesthetics, but it also depends on how we define aesthetics. The film is not beautiful, no. I mean, I didn't find beautiful frames in there, you know, the kind of frames that made me go, oh, wow, wonderful. It's mainly the complete opposite. The frames he created were as ugly as what was happening in them. Which didn't put me off. It was actually
No.
reinforcement. But there, you're right, he was very conscious of where to put the camera. You could see, for example, at the beginning, when the camera was mounted on the train, that the frame was actually neatly divided through the rail lines. So you had a pretty square and even neat frame. I'm sure he was aware of that. Which, if I may, I would like to link this to one of his other films, which is Feng Ming, A Chinese Memoir, of which people always say that it's very objective, very neutral. But it's not quite what it is. Wang Bing makes us believe that it is, and he does the same with West of the Tracks. He tries to make his choices of certain framings or the positioning of the camera. He tries to make it almost invisible, you know, the kind of innocent way of, oh, that's not what I wanted, but it happened. You've got in Feng Ming several cuts, even though you might not notice them, but there are cuts with which Wang Bing reinforces what Feng Ming is talking about, and in this way, you could say manipulates the way we are reading Feng Ming's testimony. And I think he's doing the same with West of the Tracks, that you've got certain scenes that seem like nothing, but in the end, make us read the story in a certain way, if that makes sense.
I think so. It's I make a division in my mind between beautiful photography or beautiful cinematography and effective photography. I think this is
Yes.
effective at
That is a very
creating
good
a
distinction, actually.
I think it's conscious and it creates a specific sort of mood and tone, which are things that I don't usually associate with documentaries. Maybe I'm not watching the right documentaries, but often I feel like I watch documentaries and they're there to relate facts, information. They sort of function as maybe more journalism. This, he's I think trying to give you a feeling of this district that's going into ruin, of how the people feel, of what it's doing to them on a more emotional level, maybe than something that should be intellectualized. I don't know.
Yes. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you really think that the film is a documentary? Because I was struggling figuring out what it is. I know for a fact that it is a document, but I'm not quite sure where to position it, to be honest. You know, for the standard documentary we know is kind of 90 minutes, if at all,
yes,
maybe 60, and you always have a voiceover, you've got testimony on screen, directly spoken to the camera. I think in some ways, West of the Tracks defies all of that. So where would you position it, actually?
That's a good question. It's difficult. I think maybe at first glance, what I would have maybe compared it to is Shoah, which is also longer.
Yeah.
But it's completely different in its approach. You know, Shoah is about testimony, and it's structured with its interviews. You know, it uses even the train imagery is completely different in each film. So it feels so apart from other documentaries that I've seen. And then on one hand, I feel like I don't know how fair it is of me to compare it to fiction films, because these are real people. This is really happening. It's a document. But I could almost relate it more to an experience of watching certain fiction films easier than I could to documentaries.
I have the same issue with Shoah, actually, that I'm not quite sure where to position it. I mean, it is labeled a documentary, but for me, again, it is a document rather than a documentary. West of the Tracks is even more so a document than Shoah, I find, because in Shoah, obviously, you have really the director doing the interviews while he's himself in front of the camera. So Wang Bing is not as visible, but you're right. I was thinking of specifically Lam Diaz's films. I mean, they are fiction films, but they certainly have their roots in real life in the Philippines. What is happening concerning politics and society, and just the amount of time he spends with the characters, and in that specific area where a film is shot. That really made me link it to West of the Tracks, and yet the two filmmakers couldn't be more different from one another. It is really difficult to put the film somewhere. You know, for me, West of the Tracks is not even a film for cinema. I don't know. For me, it would be a gallery work more than anything.
Yeah. I mean, I've had this conversation a little bit while talking about Satan Tango on the podcast, how I found like many people who are interested in film, it doesn't appeal to them. The people I know who appreciate Satan Tango and maybe Bellatar in general are often not film people, but it's people who I know who are interested in photography or animation or just art in general, who, you know, for them it's a little bit like spending 7 hours at an art gallery.
And that's two things come to mind right now. It is perfectly acceptable to spend 7 hours in an art gallery, but not in a cinema, because each institution obviously creates expectations. And if you go to the cinema, you do not expect a film to be 7 hours long. It's just not the right thing. You know, you go into the cinema to be entertained for 90 minutes and then leave. But in an art gallery, it's the same. It's perfectly acceptable, I mean. And the second thing that comes to mind, because you mentioned that, you know, usually when you speak to people about Satan Tango, those who are interested are usually not film people. I have Until 2008, I had no interest whatsoever in film. I wasn't even meant to have a degree in cinema. I was supposed to study English and journalism. And it was slow film that really got me. And I had a background in photography. And I think it's the exact same link, that something from photography, from my photographic eye, if you wish, there was something in slow films that really interested me, which then led me to film in general. But I think it was the same for me, that somehow I was more interested in photography and art in general than in film. And I always make the link with slow films and galleries, because there are just so many similarities.
Yes.
And I think Wang Bing should be a gallery artist. He really should, actually.
Maybe. I mean, there also seems to be maybe a tradition in mainland China that's developing of a certain type of slower film. My introduction to slow film was fantastic. It was at the Beijing Film Academy seeing Oxide 2, not knowing anything about the film. And just,
yes,
again, talked a little bit about this on the podcast in the past. But for the beginning shot, I didn't know what I was watching. I didn't know if that first shot was just going to continue for 2.5 hours. And then
yeah,
it was so exciting and intimate and cinematic. I think it is, you know, a great work of film. That it does feel very much outside the tradition of classic Hollywood type films that people generally praise. And, you know, it seems to be a template that anything that falls out of it must be bad, because those are good films, and anything that's not like, you know, Citizen Kane and classic Hollywood films,
yeah,
you know, that's the marker of quality. So it becomes difficult, I think, to convince people that, you know, there's something to these. And of course, there's other filmmakers. There's Tsai Ming-liang, who's prominent, and
who has retired, though. And he said that if he does make short films now, he will only put them into galleries, no longer in cinemas. Mm-hmm.
Or one I saw 2 years ago at Vancouver Film Festival was Kylie Blues. It was also a little bit in this tradition, although that's more, not surreal, but it made me think more of A Pitch Upon Where's Ethical. It's somewhat dreamy. This West of the Tracks, I didn't find dreamy. It was
It was hardcore reality, I found.
Yes, it's very raw.
Yeah,
the emotions you see people display at times, you know, it feels, I mean, it's not all painful emotions. There's a little bit of romance. There's people, you sort of have the basic joy of just people making it through every day of life at a certain point. But it at times reminded me, also, like, comparing it to something outside of documentary or film, it reminded me of certain works of literature, like One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. I sort of thought of at a certain point when they're, yeah, just taking into account, maybe it was a good day, all these things that happened, even under harsh conditions, you can still have a good day, maybe.
No, you're right. There is something very human in this film. There's one scene which keeps coming back to me, and that's, I think, at the end of Rust, when the workers have to spend a couple days or weeks, I can't remember, in the hospital.
Yes.
And it looks, I mean, the hospital looks really run down. You've got the workers getting these injections. But there's one worker, I think he's sitting on a bed, but he's playing the saxophone or something like that.
Yes.
And that is just beautiful. You know, you've got something run down and actually quite sad and depressing, but you've got someone there who finds the pleasure in playing the saxophone, and that is just beautiful. So the film can be quite raw, and I find overall quite sad and depressing. At the same time, there are those scenes that give you hope in a way that there are people who haven't given up. You know, they remind themselves that there are still the small pleasures and no one can take them away from them. That is really beautiful to see.
I think so too. Yeah, that moment with the saxophone sticks out in my mind too. I think maybe partly because there's no music added, so it's just the natural music within the film that you do get that joy of music. Even if the playing, it's a little bit strange. It's like Chinese folk music on a saxophone.
Ironically, this wonderful scene, I think, is succeeded shortly afterwards by the scene of a drowned worker in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
That juxtaposition was really harsh. And this is what I mean with, I think Wang Bing tries to create a very objective document, but I think the way he has edited it makes it more subjective than we think.
I think you're right. People might have this impression because it's over 9 hours long that it's somehow undistilled. But, you know, I'm sure it's an incredible amount of footage, over 2 years worth of footage to work with. What you're seeing is something that is edited, and he's mindful of the editing and what you're seeing or not seeing.
Yeah.
I think maybe also I heard there was a shorter 300-minute cut that was maybe in festivals initially, but
it was shown in Germany. Yes, it was shown in Germany once. That was even before the official premiere of the 9-hour film. And then he got back to it and kept editing, as far as I remember.
I think maybe I learned from your blog, actually, that he has maybe another long-form documentary that he's been working on. Long-form document film.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, the thing is, I don't know much about it. I came across it in that book from last year, the French language book, in which they speak about a project that is called Past in the Present Tense.
Mm-hmm.
That's the working title. And he's been wanting to do it for years and years and years. It started with Feng Ming, a Chinese memoir, or even earlier, and he really wants to do a 9-hour piece on the history of the Chinese labor camps, complete with testimony of survivors. But it's very difficult to do, because even survivors of the Chinese labor camps are not always willing to talk about the experience because they fear repression. And then obviously it is also about funding.
Right.
I mean, I reckon he could get funding in Europe. But I also wonder whether this would be good for him. Because if that news traveled to China, I'm not sure whether he wouldn't face repression because of it. Because once the funding news is out, also the Chinese will know about this project. So I'm not sure what's happening with it. I really hope that he can do it at some point, because I think it will be an important piece. There is nothing about this part of Chinese history. There is one book, but this is more, I think it's fictional accounts based on facts, which is the book he has read before he started doing Feng Ming. But this is, I think, the only document there is about this part of society, of history. So I really hope he's going to do it. But as I said, it's not easy. Funding-wise, it's not easy to speak to the survivors.
No.
So,
I mean, there's he made the film The Ditch, which is sort of recreation or fictionalized.
Yes, look. The Ditch was the first Wang Bing film I saw, and I was very disappointed.
And right.
I really didn't like the film. I found the acting horrendous, and it just didn't give me the feeling, you know, of being in the labor camp or something. Something I expected after I've read so much about Wang Bing, and then I read this book last year. And then I finally understood why this film wasn't as good as I hoped it would be. Because even he himself said that the actors were just not up to it. And they just couldn't transmit anything at all. They were standard, very stoic Chinese theater actors, and they just couldn't handle it. And I think this was the first and the last time he was touching fiction film. And I think he's really a superb documentary filmmaker, but I think fiction, that's not for him.
No.
Because in the end, his documents, regardless of what it is, they are so strong and they are really important. And I don't think you should meddle it with fiction.
No.
Not at all. It just should remain as objective as can be. I mean, film is never fully objective. But as objective as can be, because these parts of history are just so important. They need to be told, and they need to be told frankly and openly.
I know, like, especially doing politicized areas of China's history in fiction film or recreation film, like, it can be especially fraught, I think. Like, I know even Lu Chuan doing Nanjing, it was, he said, basically it wasn't worth it for him at the end, and now he's doing fantasy films and things like that. Like, I know it was a really difficult.
In what way was the film not worth it for him? Because I know the film and I found it great.
Yes. I think I wrote
an essay about it, and you know, I was working on perpetrator trauma at the time. So in what way was it not worth it for him?
I think what he said is for him that hassle of going through you know, between government and critics and people complaining about the Japanese character. He said it was too difficult. Yeah. People weren't seeing the film the way he wanted them to. That was my impression. When I spoke to him, basically what he said was that he thought he shouldn't make a film like that again. He said, I'll make something easier next time.
You mean he shouldn't, or one shouldn't?
I took it as he shouldn't.
Okay.
But, you know, he said even, like, at the end of that film, you know, and it said this number of people died. And he said this was maybe already an exaggeration because the government wanted to play up the numbers that, you know, this many people died. He said it was maybe not even true. He said from him growing up, it was twice as many people.
Yep.
And then he said when the film was being released, they said, well, really, it should say not this many people died, but more than this many people died. And he said it, at a certain point, it felt like it.
Well, it become as soon as you do these films officially through official funding from the government, you obviously became you become political game, basically.
Yes.
And I mean, I like the film. At the same time, I know full well, I've read a lot about it, that it's immensely difficult to do these type of things, both in Japan and China. Whatever covers the 1930s, that is just, you know, just don't touch it. And this is why I think that China needs directors like Wang Bing, because China is really a country that history-wise has completely closed up on itself. And it doesn't want to talk about anything. It's really, you know, the official discourse is everything is fine. But there are so many even traumatic periods of history that just really need to be worked in order for society and for the people to move forward, to progress. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as far as I know, Wang Bing is pretty much the only filmmaker who does it to that extent. I don't know whether you know any other directors in that kind of area. I don't
think so. I mean, maybe the only thing I can think of that's comparable, maybe a Petition.
It's very much in the present, right? I mean, it's not history.
No, it's not historical. I think it would be too difficult because the history, it's so easily lost. You have people who maybe don't want to talk about it, and then if you try and recreate it, it's difficult. even filming the present, you know, West of the Tracks could easily fall into that disappeared history if it wasn't caught on video. You know, if Wang Bing wanted to tell this story after the fact, I think it might be impossible. You know, he needed to be there at that moment.
That's true. Yeah. There is a film from last year or 2 years ago. I saw it in Festival Scope. It's by a Chinese director called Fan Jian. Don't know whether you have seen the film called My Land.
I don't think so. No.
When I saw West of the Tracks, Remnants, exactly, when everyone is, well, when the Rainbow Row is getting demolished and everyone has to move, it's getting relocated. That immediately reminded me of that film because My Land is pretty much about the relocation of an entire part of society. And I can't remember whether it was a documentary or a fiction film. I would think it's a documentary because there are also some very voyeuristic, secretly shot episodes. But one family refuses to leave their house. Exactly what's happening in West of the Tracks as well. And then they get their electricity cut, their water cut, and you've got the officials coming, threatening them. So there are quite a few similarities between that film and parts of Remnants. It's something that I think is just repeating itself on a daily basis in China right now. So it's popping up in Chinese contemporary film as well, at least in independent cinema. Because it has to be independent cinema. Official cinema would never show this. I don't think so.
No, it goes into such stark contrast with the idea that China is prospering right now. It's prosperous times, becoming wealthy, becoming successful. The hard work is paying off. It's strange the sort of melding of the capitalist values with the old communist values. It's not always clear where the lines are. Yeah,
exactly. I find this quite interesting with West of the Tracks because we know that it was shot at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. And at that moment, even now, China is officially not a capitalist country. It's not. On paper, it's not. But this film shows you that China is probably a capitalist country at its most obvious. It is the humans have no values. They're just there to work. They don't get paid properly. No one looks after them. They're just pieces in a huge capitalist machine. And if they're no longer needed, then they just get rid of them. You know, and I would say that it happens not to the same extent, obviously, but it happens in all Western economies as well, because this is essentially what capitalism is. What you see in West of the Tracks is really just the most brutal and the most obvious characteristic of capitalism. And that's why I think that this is such an important document that really needs to be seen.
It's just thinking about the Chinese history again, like it's such an incredible amount of turmoil in one century.
Yes.
You know, in some ways this feels like, because it comes at the end of the century, it feels like West of the Tracks, in some way it's a summation as much as it is a look at the present.
Yes. Yes, it can be seen this way, yes. And thinking of the lack of historical material in China, you know, for me this is very much mentality as well, because in the end Europeans didn't have a much more peaceful 20th century, but they you know that there are countries that have started to work through, whether it was politically or through films, artworks, at least they have started. China really completely blocks out everything, and I'm not entirely sure why this is the case. But I see the difference here in Europe between Germany, where I'm coming from, and France, where I'm now living. The way these two countries deal with almost the exact same history during the 20th century, this is fascinating to see. And I think it really has something to do with the mentality of the people as well, and how they grow up as children. Because if you are always told, you know, this never happened, or just don't talk about it, you know, it's as if this history never existed. Which brings me to a book I just recently read. You probably know The Society of the Spectacle by Guy Debord.
Yes.
Do you know that he has actually written commentaries on his own book?
No, I didn't. I
Okay, I didn't know it either until I saw it in the bookshop. So I bought the book. Basically, it was a commentary on his first book 20 years later. He wrote this book in the '80s.
maybe more authors should do this.
And he had one very good point, and he said, I mean, and that was in the 80s, that it's very much in the interest of politicians and of the media to make history disappear. History no longer exists. We are living in an eternal present. And that's the thing, you know, if you forget your history, especially the brutal history I mean, so many countries have been through. This very much opens the way of history repeating itself. And in some ways, the work of Wang Bing in China, of Laf Diaz in the Philippines, these are filmmakers who really work against the grain, against this forgetting,
Yes.
against this desire to forget. It's really an interesting part of the book. I genuinely recommend it. It opens your eyes, actually. And I think there's a lot to it that can be used for an analysis of film as well, of how we read as now is the case. Wang Bing's films, Wang Bing's historical documents, actually. So yeah. Oh, I'm getting super excited about this book. I'm
No,
sorry.
I'm gonna have to track it down now.
Yeah, but to me, this is really the beauty of the film, that it combines history with the present. That's really wonderful, and this is very similar in what is Laf Diaz doing. He also combines past and present, which I find has a lot of strength in it. It really, those film works touch me personally a lot more than films that are just set either in the present or the past. Because nothing is exclusive, you know, it's just the past is not just in the past, it always comes back.
And the reoccurring tracks, like it made me feel like I'm just being pulled further and further in. And I mean, it's a literal tracking shot when, he turns the camera and you see
Yes.
these endless, seemingly endless buildings that are empty, collapsing. You
Yeah.
see through all the windows. It feels, again, comparing it to fiction film, like it feels like maybe a tracking shot that a fiction filmmaker might conceive, but it's there in life. So, it becomes very powerful.
The first thing that popped into my head when I saw these scenes was the very first tracking shot in cinema, which I think I'm pretty sure the camera was attached to a
I
train.
think so, yes.
I'm pretty sure, and somehow this popped into my head. I don't know whether he wanted to make the reference or not. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's really just in my head. But you're absolutely right. The movement through the I mean, in the end, the whole complex just becomes a dead desert. That's all there is left. And driving through it slowly as well. I mean, it's not even a fast train. It's really a slow movement. It felt eerie.
Yes.
Not quite scary, but there was something that was quite uncomfortable somehow, because you knew that you were on a journey through emptiness, through nothingness, and this always makes us uncomfortable, you know, because you know that there was life before. Where is life now? I find this a these scenes immensely powerful.
It's like entering the zone in Stalker or something like that.
Oh,
Maybe.
yes, no, that's true. I never thought about that. That's true,
You
yes.
see, it's.
That's also completely void of life, you know,
Yes.
but you know that there was life before. So what happened to that life? It's this kind of thing that I absolutely love with films, you know, that it's films that really make me think.
Yeah. That's so interesting comparing it to the first tracking shot. Like, I have a friend, we've discussed a little bit before that with the digital technology, it's almost brought film back to the beginning of cinema all over again. You see the sort of
Exactly.
inventiveness. It
It
it's
is.
like the way films looked over 100 years ago.
That is a really good point, and I was thinking, God, I think that was at the beginning of my slow cinema research, that actually slow cinema very much goes back to the beginning of film, because in the end, when there was, you know, no editing invented or even thought of, you just had to have long takes and all these kind of things, you know, it was just back to the very basics. And maybe this is why I enjoy it so much, because there's not much, not much, I don't know.
It's like it's not a cluttered version of the language of cinema. It's simple.
Yes, it's simple, exactly. But it's still very powerful, and I think this power comes through the simplicity.
Yes. You know, it's some films you feel like, you know, shot, reverse shot, medium shot, in some way it holds them back from, you know, it feels like it's become too ingrained, rigidly ingrained in a certain way of expression, you know, and I like films like this that sort of remind you that there's modes of expression in film that are outside of maybe what you would learn in film school, I think.
No, that's right. What we see in current film, well, in current popular films, is actually limiting the viewer.
Yes.
I find, because you can't think for yourself, you can't, you know, what I really loved was the idea. A Peter Pong, Vera Sitakul, spoke about it in a video. He said that, I mean, he studied architecture, and for him,
that's right, yeah,
film is like a house, and you walk into that house and you can go into any room whenever you want. You know, there is no, you have to go into this room, then into this room, then into this room. You are free. And this is what doesn't happen in popular film anymore. You are taken by the hand and you are told in which room to go. Whereas in, well, slow films, for example, like Wang Bing's, it's kind of you really enter this house and you're free to go wherever you want, which is really lovely.
Right. No, it's beautifully said. I like that. I guess that probably gets close to wrapping things up. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add, or.
No, I think that's pretty much it. I start to become brain dead. I mean, it's a 9-hour film.
I mean, that's another thing
we
too.
Should,
is
we should maybe do a second part of it. You
maybe
know, a second part of the podcast.
I mean, at a certain point, we're supposed to revisit it on the podcast proper, but I don't know when that would be. But no, well, thank you so much for coming in to talk about it. As soon as I saw it, I thought, like, I need to talk about this with someone. Who do I know who would watch this? Because I think, like, I forget who, somebody said once a little bit critically or sarcastically that, like, oh, when you watch 9-hour film or 14-hour film, I think they were mostly talking about Out One, that the achievement's not of the filmmaker, it's of the viewer. But I think maybe it's a little bit of both, actually, that somebody is willing to engage with what a filmmaker put into all this time.
Because, you know, the filmmaker has put so much work and effort into it, and I often think that we as the viewer have the duty as well to give the filmmaker our time, because the film work and the director both deserve it.
Yes. I think, so. Like, often people who are skeptical of longer films, slower films, they'll use the phrase endurance test, but I think it's more.
Well, To be fair, it is an endurance
Well,
test,
I was going to say it's a
and
scheduling test. It's a
well, that as well,
yes.
yes. But as I said, you know, for me, it doesn't make a difference whether I watch 8 hours Life Diaz or Wang Bing
Yes.
or 8 hours a TV series. I have 8 hours free,
Right.
so it doesn't matter what I watch. And my first very long film, that was Melancholia by Life Diaz, 8 hours. And I genuinely bought the tickets only because for fun, because I never thought I would survive it. I think the longest film at the time was, I think, 2 hours or just over 2 hours. And I thought 8 hours, no. But it was the best film experience I've ever had. And I didn't need all the drinks I bought and stuff. You know, I didn't need it. It was so engaging. And this is what people are afraid of, that it's 8 hours, nothing. But that's not the case. You know, there's actually something happening, like 9 hours west of the tracks. There's actually so much happening, but it happens over time. And I think we really lost the feeling of just taking the time, you know, because even our life doesn't happen in an instant. I mean, we live 80 years or something,
You
where
might.
it's just it. Well, I might. Okay.
I don't know
Maybe
if I will.
60, I don't know. No, but you know, our life is routine. It is really slow. It is. The only thing that is fast is probably our car, our computer, our Wi-Fi, our smartphone. It makes us believe that our life is fast, but it's not. And we really lost the feeling of this slowness, which is actually very real. It's not, you know, the films by Wang Bing are not some artificial slowness on screen. It's not. It's just more real, or very close
It's a
to
pace of
our
life,
life as well.
yes. Yeah, I think
Yes,
so.
exactly.
It's I wish I could have seen it in the theater, because I found when you're seeing a slow film in the theater, you're a little bit trapped, but in a good way. You know, I feel like
Yes.
you know, if I go and see I last summer I got to see Stalker on the big screen for the first time, and it was sort of nice because
Oh, I had that joy as well a couple of years ago. It was beautiful.
it's
It was
really
wonderful.
special, but partly like
Yes.
I feel like when I watch it at home, there's on some level there's always the temptation, you know, I could pull out my iPod and play a game on it or pause it. You know, I
Oh, you
think
wouldn't. Oh,
what's
come on. You wouldn't do
no
that
no
with a Tchaikovsky
I
film.
wouldn't, but I think you know, you can't
No, there
pause
is
it
the
when it's in the
temptation, of
theater, so
course.
you feel like
Yes.
you're not in control. The film's in control in some
Yep.
way.
No, it's absolutely true. And you know, there was, I don't know whether you've read this interview that Joanna from Festivalist did with me, where I said that unfortunately I see that VOD is the future of independent filmmaking at the moment. I wished it would be different, because I know myself that if I watch films at home on my laptop or on my telly, there are just so many distractions.
Yes.
I really hate it. I would much rather go into the cinema. But unfortunately, there are just so many cinemas that refuse to show really good independent and even slow films because they're boring. And yes, they don't bring the viewers. They don't make a lot of money out of the films. And that's why I said, unfortunately, VOD is the future for independent film at the moment, which is very sad, and I really hope that it will change. But I, you know, after the news that Fandor is now moving into the mainstream as well, I'm genuinely losing my hope.
It's I mean it's difficult, you know. I guess you're not always sure what's going to be. I guess it helps, you know, if there's distribution to have the one big draw that pays for all the other ones. I don't know. I mean, you probably have better insight
Yes.
into it than I do, but
Well, I can say that that our platform is still very small, and we have. But this is the thing, you know. I don't do it for the money. And we have set our film prices, $4.99 and $1.99, exactly at this point because we need to cover our costs. That's all. You know, if there are VOD platforms that really want to get the viewers and they make it damn cheap, it's really dumping the prices and the filmmakers don't get anything out of it. So you had last year one or two French VOD platforms that went bust, and they really sold their films for $1.99, regardless of whether it was, I don't know, 4 hours or 20 minutes. And this is just not a proper model at all. But if you want to make money, you either show mainstream. You will need to show mainstream if you want to make money and if you want to have a lot of views a month, or you need to get a lot of funding. I genuinely doubt that. I mean, I know that there are across the world a lot of niche VOD platforms. There's one in China, for example. Well, no, China? Taiwan, I think. The interesting thing, well, I will finish my thought first. There is a VOD platform that is entirely focused on LGBT, for example, which is great. And yeah, there are several VOD platforms across the planet that have certain niches, but no one can tell me that they actually make profit. I genuinely doubt it. Because it's not something you make profit with. If you do, then you know, magic happens. But yeah, as for Taiwan and China, by the way, we had several Taiwanese viewers who couldn't see our films because China blocked it.
That's too bad. I mean, they do that. It's
Yeah, because our streaming is our streaming comes from Amazon Web Service, and Amazon is blocked in China. Oh, so that's the issue. So they need a VPN and things just in order to see our films. So it's also that kind of thing that you have to deal with once you go into online film distribution, and as we do, show the films worldwide, because we don't do geo-blocking or anything. You
No.
can watch our films wherever you are, as long as you've got internet access. But you know, you've got these sort of regional or national policies where we weren't even aware of it. You know, there is someone from Taiwan telling you, well, I bought the film, but I can't see anything, and all you see that everything is correct and everything is working. There are no errors on your website, and then you start to wonder, is it maybe a political thing? This is really incredible what you get to know when you start this sort of online distribution business. I have to say, I learned a lot already.
I'm sure they'd appreciate that. Like, both China and Taiwan, I found, like, of the places I've been to, it seemed like the film communities there were among the most film literate, people who watched the widest variety of films and could appreciate so many different types of films.
But it happens on the black market,
Exactly.
and that's my problem. You know, I'm sure that over there I would have a lot of people who would appreciate our films, but I don't know how to reach these people.
I mean, while I was there, the bootleg DVDs were still a big deal. Maybe they still are. But I remember, like, films I didn't realize were even available anywhere. They would have bootleg DVDs of incredibly rare films or Czech films. I probably own more Czech language films I bought in China than I did. Like, last time I was in Czech Republic, I wanted to buy up a classic Czech language films. I go to a video store and they have Shrek dubbed into Czech. They don't have them.
Oh God, I would love to see that. Shrek in Czech. I'm sure that's amazing.
Maybe it is. But you sort of feel like, there's people who are appreciating films more than the people in the country I'm from. It's sort of remarkable, I think.
You also have that in South America a lot at the moment. I can see that from the film submissions we receive and also from the viewers, because we can see whether we get views from Europe or outside Europe. And there are really a lot of interesting films coming from Mexico.
Or
my favorite film from South America. That's really incredible. Sorry?
Oh, my favorite film from maybe 2 years ago was Ho Ha with Viggo Mortensen.
I don't think I know that one.
It's Viggo Mortensen. He's Danish.
Oh, yes. Sorry, by Lisandro Alonso. Yes. Sorry, I misunderstood.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, but that was a brilliant film.
That was amazing. But I think they said it was more popular internationally than it was in South America. So.
That is usually the case with slow films in general. So,
I saw some of the comments. People said, like, "Oh, why is this Spanish so bad?" And like the characters, like I know Mortensen speaks Spanish fluently, but the character's Danish. It's not his first language.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know, things like that. I thought, like, well, that's not a real criticism. That's
it's you know, that's why I hardly ever read film criticism. It's just there's so much junk in there.
Yeah,
where you just think, have you actually used your brain? Have you thought about what you were writing?
Right.
It's really incredible how low some film criticism is.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, I mean, not to get too hard on film critics, but sometimes they deserve it.
No,
but...
it's fine. We love them.
But like sometimes, just the things you read, they make you so upset that, like, you know, it's somebody whose job should be to understand or appreciate a film, and like they're completely incapable of it. Or a lot of times I find like critics have, especially lately, like an idea of whether they're going to like a film before.
Yeah.
Or whether they're going to hate a film in advance. And then all they look for is evidence to support this while they're watching it.
Yeah. And this is the case with slow cinema criticism, especially. You have quite a few critics, you know, that they hate slow cinema and they write film criticism. And it's just that, you know, full well that they just watch the film in order to find proof that it's shit. And I just don't get it. I don't know what the point of their job is.
Right.
At the same time, I know that a lot of film critics, especially those that are attached to newspapers, they don't really have the time to think about their criticism. Mm-hmm. It's just they go into a film and then they've got, I don't know, 1 hour or something to write their critique, especially when it comes to film festivals like the Cannes Festival. They just don't have the time. It's fast criticism, and that is never good. And this is why I really enjoy doing my blog and taking my time. You know, I can watch a film today and write about it in 5 weeks just because I can. And I would never want to give up this freedom. If someone asks me to write a critique, I do it. I'm very happy to do it. But you really need to give me time. Otherwise, I just can't do it. Because for me, a film really needs to, I don't know, it needs to breathe before I can really decide whether it's a good film or a bad film. For quite a few films, fair enough, you know, I see the first frame and I think, oh, wow, this is my film.
Right.
Got it. But nevertheless, in order to write about it, you still need time, because you really need to go through that film again. And I don't know, I think this is something that film criticism has lost in the last couple of years.
I mean, maybe. Sometimes it seems like it's always been that way when you see these brilliant films and then look back and, oh, they had horrible reviews. Or I think, like, especially
that's
now,
true.
Like, not just the pace of the films themselves, but the pace of their process going into theaters. Like, it's sped up so that, you know, most movies make all their money in the first weekend.
At the same time, we are now trained really to look for... I mean, we all... Okay. Those who have studied film or whatever, you're fully aware of film grammar.
Yes.
You know what certain colors mean. You know what certain camera angles mean, or are supposed to mean, put it like this. So you just look for those very simple things and you interpret it according to this existing framework. So I guess this is what film critics do in order to save time rather than look beyond this framework.
I think so. And things that don't fit into that framework, it must be because the filmmakers don't know what they are doing. That's the assumption I see a lot of the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or I don't know. Even, like, again, with slow cinema, sometimes what I see people lump in with slow cinema, like they're not slow at all. I'm sort of shocked, like,
That's also very
yeah.
true. Yes. The slow cinema term is now really applied to whatever is just a bit slower than the average. For me, slow cinema somehow means more than just having a couple slow shots.
Yes.
But I have been asked a couple of times how I would define slow cinema, and I always say I can't define it. Slow cinema, for me personally, is not something that comes from the head, but from the heart or from the gut. It's really something I feel. I see, for example, the first frame of a film, and I can tell whether it's going to be slow cinema or not. So yeah, I actually make fast decisions when it comes to slow cinema. That's kind of ironic.
No. Well, I think like sometimes it's not even just the pace, there's a sort of quietness to a lot of these
It's the
films, a
mood. Yeah,
mood. Yeah,
exactly.
it's like I've heard it also described as an anti-cinema, which like sounds kind of like a deprecating comment, but you know, maybe it's more accurate in that it's not maybe necessarily the actual pace so much as that it goes against these sort of popular cinematic conventions. Yeah, I don't know if it's
If you know
yeah.
the if slow cinema was anti-cinema, the definition that comes out of that of cinema, just the term cinema, is really bad actually.
Like I think, you know, these are among the most cinematic films that I've seen. Like I tell people, like Oxeye 2, it's in CinemaScope. It's beautifully framed. You know, it's as cinematic as anything you're going to see anywhere else. You know, even amongst classic films. But you know, for some reason, it's not necessarily what people expect, so it's hard to convince people. Maybe I shouldn't convince people. I shouldn't try. If they like it, they like it. But
I stop convincing people because you can't. You
right.
know, they need to see slow films, and then either they feel something or they don't. You know, it's completely up to them, really. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm really grateful that you were here to talk about this film, and I have a lot to think about now. So, thank you so much,
Good.
Nadine.
You're very welcome.
If people want to find you on the internet, if you want them to find you on the internet, where could they look?
If they want to find me on the internet, through my website, theartsofslowcinema.com or taofilms.com, or on Twitter, my handle is Art and Slow Film.
And if people want to follow the show, it's over on flixwise.com or on iTunes if you'd like to rate and review. And if you want to follow the show, it's at FlixWise on Twitter. And if you'd like to follow me, of all people, on Twitter, at MovieKessler. So thank you for listening. And until next time, keep it slow.